we're in business. Let's see. Eco exams, if you haven't picked yours up, are down in the front. You can get those after. The retakes, for those of you who missed more than 5 points, the retakes are tomorrow and Wednesday. If you can't make either of those, then schedule something independently, individually, with Julie or with me. Okay. And the retake is same format. Let's see, we didn't give you any feedback on the eco exam, did we, first time through? I actually did calculate the percentage of people who passed it, and I didn't bring that, but it was 70 people out of 120. So 70 passed, 50 didn't. That's higher. I think that's, if somebody does the math quickly, it's 60%. It's higher than in past years. So either it was an easier exam, or you're smarter than past classes, which I would, that's the hypothesis I will fly on. Okay? Exercise assignment 4 is due today. So there's a pile of them out there on the desk. Other questions, housekeeping stuff? You're all okay. You want to get right to families. Okay, let's get right to families. Just a quick review where we were. Is I had talked about the chapter in Garbarino, and you had started to raise some questions about that, and I had promised that I was going to go back and look at some of the characteristics, the statements made in that chapter, and be a little more critical of them. So I want to do that. I did some of the critique on Wednesday, but I want to point out what are, for me, some of the shortcomings and limitations of the presentation that Garbarino and Abramowitz give in that chapter. The chapter as it stands is legitimate and useful, but its limitations are crucial. If you're going to understand and study families, particularly from the perspective of this course, because what it comes down to for me is that they present, to cut to the bottom line, they present a series of perspectives on the study of families which is appropriate only if one is at the same time studying marriage and parenting. And if one assumes that families means first marriages with children, and that covers about half, I would say, or fewer. It covers a minority of the entities that I would call families. So it is a traditional view which is tied to marriage, a traditional view which is tied to childbearing and child rearing as essential features for families. And from my perspective, and I invite you to examine that perspective. Don't accept it whole cloth, but examine it as we read about families and as you think about what counts as a family. I would ask you to think about whether that's an adequate view. And I will simply tell you that from my perspective, it is not an adequate view if the purpose of studying families is to find out how they affect development. If more than half of people are in families that are not described in that chapter, then the chapter is not presenting an adequate perspective on what is a family. Very quickly, in the early part of the chapter, there were two definitional phrases that were used. One is a small group of people sharing love, intimacy, and responsibility for children. So if you're not sharing responsibility for children, then you're not a family. Are love and intimacy and children necessary for a family? What does that mean for all the dysfunctional, abusive families in our society? Does that mean they're not families? Then what are they? And if they're married, and marriage is one of the criteria for a family, and if they have children, are they not a family? Or are they somehow an abnormal family or one that we have to study in a different course? So that definition doesn't work for me. We talked briefly about whether the society serves the macrosystem and reflects it, or whether in fact families create the macrosystem. And one of the points that I made, tried to make, is that as families change, as families don't follow the norms of a particular macrosystem, they are in the process changing that macrosystem. The macrosystem doesn't have the privilege of defining what is and is not a family, except as the macrosystem creates laws that define it, as it creates or states norms and expectations that define family. But in fact, families are free within the limits of what is legal and perhaps moral to do it any way they want. They may not be covered by particular laws, but can we say that because families don't fit the norm, that they're not families? We can, but we need to be very cautious about defining somebody's family as illegitimate, illegal, non-conforming, any of those other pejorative terms that we tend to use. One of the definitions suggested that the three commonalities in looking at families are marriage, childbearing, and kinship. I'm going to question marriage because, in fact, a large number of people raising children are not married. If you require marriage as a definitional essence and essential, then are you a family only if you're married, after you get married, while you're married, and what do you do about remarriage, and are you a family if your children grow up? No. Not sure. Okay. Problematic. More than 20% of first marriages don't result in children. Does that mean those couples are not families? Because they haven't created a family of procreation. Is intent to have children enough? Maybe, maybe not. Kinship. Kinship is a matter of social definition. It often implies economic rights and responsibilities. Economic rights and responsibilities are defined by law, not by kinship. Kinship terms are used in legal definitions. The legal definitions do not define the kinship. They define the rights and responsibilities, and also the limitations. In most states, it's not permissible to marry somebody who is your direct ancestor or descendant. In most states, it is not legal to marry a sibling. But those are definitions that are based on marriage, not definitions of family. Rights and responsibilities come from biological descent or childbearing, or they come from legal bonds, marriage, civil union in Vermont, adoption, or fostering. But they do not come, nor do they define, family. So the law, in fact, describes contractual rights and responsibilities for people on the basis of childbearing or on the basis of creating a legal contract, marriage, civil union, or adoption. But kinship is defined socially and varies across cultures and across macrosystems. And what I left you with, what we were tackling, was who's in your family? Because you get to define kinship there. And kinship definitions change. I'm not sure whether I mentioned one of the problems with the chapter is that they talk about the sociologists too. Did I talk about family of affiliation? Okay. The sociologists define two kinds of families. The family of origin, which is the one you're born into or get adopted into, and then you have really two families of origin. Or the family of procreation, which is the one that you create in order to or by having children. But that those two kinds don't cover many of the families that people actually live in. And I'll bet that those two don't describe all of the people that you described as being in your family. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So we use a third term, which is not used in the chapter, which is a family of affiliation, which is a group of people, group is always more than one, who are in a family which they were not born into, and it is a family that is not going to produce children. So it's neither a family of origin nor a family of procreation. It is what happens when people like me have families of origin, as I do, a family of procreation, as I do, and marry other people with whom we do not have children and to whom we are not biologically or otherwise related, to create a different family which falls under the category of a family of affiliation. My second wife and I and our children create a family of affiliation. But it's not a family of procreation. Our children have families of origin which were their original parents' families of procreation, but they're not our family of procreation. Similarly, many people choose to live together and create a family without having children, without getting married, and often have responsibility for children or take on responsibility for raising other people, but they're not a family of procreation, nor are they a family of origin for those children. So we need a category from my perspective, that's much broader and which is not based on being born into it or bearing children in it. And that's an umbrella term, the family of affiliation. The chapter, I think, well, let me say something else about the chapter. One of the statements in the chapter is that the traditional norm for our culture is for a man and a woman to marry and then raise the children together. That is a traditional norm, and about half of us do that. But large numbers of people don't do that. That norm is changing. If norm is defined by what a majority of people do, the marriage part of that is becoming much less the norm. And remarriage is becoming much closer to the norm. The number of people in the United States who have two marriages or three is increasing dramatically, although it's always been higher than anybody would expect, because back in the old days, real tradition, people lost spouses fairly regularly and remarried. So second and third marriages have always been common. We just haven't seen them as traditional or normative. Not all couples have children. 20% perhaps don't. That's only first marriages. If you count second, third, and fourth marriages, far more of them do not have children. So children and marriage don't necessarily go together. And from the chapter, the marital institution is in many ways the center of the family in culture and in practice. In our culture, perhaps, in practice, that's diminishing. And it probably is the center, that's sort of a little pun there for me, the center of the family. It probably is. You start the couple relationship, and often you start childbearing, and then you get married. And then you end being married, so you get divorced. And if marriage is the center of the family, we need to account for all of the work that's going on before, and the number of children who are born before the marriage, and the marriage never happens for many of them, but they still get raised, they still get parented, they still grow up, they still develop, and therefore they're of interest for this course. And what happens after the marriage, as you take the marriage apart, and perhaps remarry, is that when the marriage ends, the family does not. That's a motto from our post-divorce child-rearing workshops, which I supervise. Divorce ends a marriage, it does not end the family. People still keep parenting. And if they're parenting and raising children, then probably we still need to think of them as a family, and certainly the children do, and many of you are in that situation of being in a family that is no longer married, but having two parents, or three, or four, and remarried parents, so you get to experience marriage again. So my conclusion about this chapter is that it's a pretty good review of viewpoints about families of procreation formed in first marriages. And when you add Duvall's life cycle, it's really a parenting cycle, and it doesn't cover divorce and remarriage and step-parenting or any of those things. So we're going to go way beyond that chapter. But that chapter does provide a nice overview of the traditional view that marriage and childbearing are in the middle of families. But I'm only going to say it 52 more times. I'm going to say it once now, and I promise not to say it again today. We have to be very careful in how we talk about families and how we define them, because if you're leaving out half the children in the society, by your definition, are they familyless? Probably not. If you're only studying marriages, are you getting a valid picture of what is happening for children in the society? Definitely not. If your statistics on which you base your descriptions of poverty or child well-being or effectiveness of parents, if those statistics are based on married couples, then you have a skewed view of the state of children. So, if the goal, as these authors say theirs is, but they don't carry it out, if your goal is to be inclusive, and my goal is, and our goal for the course is to be inclusive, then you want the broadest possible definition of family. And from my perspective, what Bronfenbrenner does that many other researchers don't do is that Bronfenbrenner provides us, as I suggested before, a framework for looking at everybody's ecosystem and trying to understand each person's development. And if you're going to do that, then you have to acknowledge that a lot of people don't have married parents. A lot of married people who are developing along very nicely, thank you, do not have children. And if you want to study all of them, then you have to make the most inclusive definition of family, or not define family. That's another option. Not talk about family, but I inherited the name of this course. It's the family context of human development. And the only way I can study everybody's human development then is to have a definition of family that goes far beyond the traditional definition. It can't be hinged on marriage. It can't be hinged on being parents. It can't be hinged on biological connections. It has to include those, but then look at all of the other varieties as well. Okay, what I had you doing was describing or listing everybody in your family. You listed their names, then you indicated how each was related to you. And then the next part of that was to be write a definition of family that's consistent so that it includes everybody that you listed. How many of you were able to do that? Define family in a way that included everybody that you listed. I know you're afraid to raise your hands because you're afraid I'll call on you and ask you what your definition was. Right? Okay. That's pretty inclusive. The people you're related to by blood, that means your biological ancestors and all their collaterals, whether you like them or not. The people you love, that's family of affiliation, and some other people that probably are in there. The people you live with, we're talking about roommates? Or cohabitation. Right. Okay, so going beyond the assigned roommates that came to you from Res Life. as a foster sibling. I never thought about that before. Res Life assigns people to be your siblings, right? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Okay. So that's a pretty inclusive definition. And it got everybody that you consider family. Other examples? How many of you couldn't write a definition that fit everybody that you had listed? Why not? I'm sorry. Okay, so it was, you had people that you listed as being in your family, but they're not related by blood. They're not related by legal bond. Yeah. And so they were people out there. Those people you love? That would fit everybody. Okay. Do any of you have family members who are not related by blood? I love this. Should we say genes? You know, blood sounds a little, you know, makes my blood curdle. Let's say genetically related, shall we? People that are not related by genetics, not related by legal bond, that you don't like, but are in your family. Okay, so she didn't talk about the affect involved because that may not be a definitional requirement for family. And that's the point I'm getting at. That if you don't like somebody, can that person still be in your family? Some of you have ex-step-parents. Right? Any of you have ex-step-parents? Yeah. You had a parent who remarried and then divorced, and so you've got this evil stepmother or stepfather who's an ex-stepmother stepfather, and you don't like them, but you still have to include them in your family. Well, sometimes they are related because you have half-siblings, which really defines them as genetically related if they're actually half-siblings. Sometimes they're in the family because you have a step-sibling who's not biologically or legally related to you that you actually like. And if you have a step-sibling that you actually like, then that person's parents whom you don't like, the ex-step-parent, may still have to be included in your family. Didn't cover your situation. Okay, you still want to keep him, her out of the family. Yeah. Okay, so she's going to keep the half-sibling, but throw out the ex-step-parent, even though your parent is still paying alimony to that person, which maybe is why you don't like. Well, okay. That raises another related issue, and I'm going to jump to that issue. And was there a question? Did I miss a question? Sure. Go. So you want it to be based only on affect. So if you don't like your parent, out of the family. Yeah.
I mean, well, it's kind of like the reason comes from just like what we think of, like a definition, maybe like what we learned as a kid, not really on like what we may think of as ourselves.
Okay, let me talk about the two issues that I think are going. I'm going to try to resolve that. And take it into account. I'm not going to dismiss it. I'm going to say, yes, I think that affect is important And I'm going to propose that there are a number of different characteristics of relationship that need to be incorporated into an inclusive view of families. But one of the ways to resolve that issue is to think about, from a developmental perspective, remember that the mesosystem, or the ecosystem in general, is defined from the perspective of the person that you are talking about. Remember that? So a setting that is in your mesosystem may be in somebody else's exosystem. Same setting, depending on whether you go in it or not. I'm going to suggest that we have to take a similar individual perspective to make sense out of families, definitionally. That we're going to have to define the family from an individual's perspective. And in fact, we do have to do that because biologically, everybody in your family is related to you in a different way. And people who are your uncles are somebody else's brothers. So the kinship terms, in fact, are all relational. Every single one of them describes a relationship that is two-sided and which is different. So the individual person may be related in a dozen or more different ways to people in the family. So think about your parents. You have a person who is a father, a son, a brother, a husband, an uncle, a granduncle, a grandnephew, a great-grandson. All of those kinship terms apply to the same person, thinking about all of the people who are in the family. And that's just the biological and legal relationships. Okay. So we traditionally describe the kinship relationships have to from the individual perspective. So let's think about defining the family from an individual perspective. That will help, I think, resolve some of the conflicts. It also takes into account the fact that the family that you define or that is defined for you changes over time. It constantly changes. And you have no control over that. People come into it. People come out of it. People marry into it. People are born into it. They become related to you biologically or legally. And you often have absolutely no control over that whatsoever. And it changes sometimes several times a year during parts of our lives. Our siblings marry, they bring people into the family, they bring their in-laws into the family. Parents have to deal with the fact that our children choose people. We can't arrange their marriages. It would be nice. I understand, now that both my kids are married, I understand arranged marriages and why they're so attractive. I happen to like and respect and be very comfortable with the parents of my children's spouses. But I had nothing to do with picking them. I didn't even meet them. In one case, I had met the husband because he was a professor here, but the father, my daughter-in-law's father, was a professor here, and I knew him professionally. And then I met her mother, literally, at the wedding. And my daughter's in-laws, I met at the wedding. You know, here they are. Here, by the way, Bob and Ann. You know, you are now about to share grandchildren with them. You will have Christmas with them. You will share your daughter, your most precious relative in the whole world, next, equal with your son. They brought these people into my family, and I had nothing to say about it. They brought their whole genetic load into the family. So my grandchildren don't have genes that I chose. I blessed their father, But his genes came from his parents, and I had nothing to do with being able to check them out. Anyway, long way around to say that families change regularly, and you don't have any control over that. And your family is a dynamic, a very fluid group of people. And it will get more fluid as you get older. Okay? So, where do we come down? You have definitions that you tried. I'm going to give you mine. Since everybody has one. And I'm going to tell you how I got to it and why I think it resolves some of the issues that come up in trying to define people that you would say are in your family. And I'm also going to say very strongly, you don't have to buy this one. It works for me. You do need to understand it, because when I talk about family in this course, this is the definition I'm going to use. It's like everybody else's in that it includes the two things you have to include in any definition: people related to each other by genetic kinship or legal bond, marriage, adoption, or foster contract, civil union in Vermont. And it adds a third, which gets at your affiliations and your affections, which is commitment. So those people you choose to live with and want to call your family, want to include in your definition of family, are covered by commitment. Commitment implies, but doesn't require, positive affect. It doesn't require love, because I can't define love. So positive affect I can do. But it doesn't require love, because sometimes people are committed to each other without loving each other, I think. And the unfinished business at the bottom is that I'm not sure whether the commitment needs to be mutual or not. And I think if you combine that note with what I just said about family being defined by from each person's individual perspective, then one can probably say that commitment need not be mutual, but that if it is, then you have two people who agree on their families overlapping at that particular point. They agree that they're part of each other's family. And I'm not sure I'm convinced by that, so I leave that one open. Okay? And again, this is what I've come to wrestling with, all of those conditions and difficulties in using other definitions and using it, trying to be as inclusive as possible. So if a group of people want to define themselves as a family, I'm not going to object to that if they're related in any of these three ways. And commitment is a pretty broad term. Okay, now we get to the real assignment for today. Right? Did you have fun with this one over the weekend? From a Brontembrenarian perspective, what is love? What kind of dyadic, romantic dyadic relationship do you want to have in your future? Maybe you have it now. Maybe you've had it in the past. What would you like to have? How would you describe that? And what are the most common problems you and people you know encounter in romantic relationships? Okay. Romantic relationships are where many family microsystems begin. Okay. When two people get interested in each other and decide that they would like to spend more time with each other. So courtship is part of the early process. occasionally there's not much of that. Sometimes people get heavily invested in being related to each other without going through much of a romantic relationship. And I always, kind of nostalgically, am reminded at this point by a student who was in this course a number of years ago who had to drop out after about 3 weeks into the course. He was enjoying the course. He liked Bronfenbrenner. But he decided he needed to work more because he was absolutely determined to be a responsible and providing parent for his child who had been born, and he was interested in doing that, and he discovered that the state was going to require him to pay more than his student loans would allow him to pay as a parent, because he was going to be providing support for the next 18 years for a child who was conceived with a woman whose last name he didn't know. One of those things that can happen if you hang out with the wrong people and drink too much. One night stands actually can lead to conception. And they did in his case. There was no courtship involved. It was what we now at UVM, I believe, call a hookup. And they both had rather rude awakenings. They didn't even wake up together that first morning. In fact, they never slept together ever again. But they both discovered something about the legal system and what it requires of parents. And first thing he discovered was that she wasn't using contraception as she had drunkenly said she was. So that was sort of a surprise. Second, DNA tests are pretty positive in determining who the father is, even if there might have been a couple of other possibilities, they were ruled out. So he's the biological father. And her rude awakening was that once that father is defined, you cannot cut him out of the child's life. Especially if he's willing to be involved. No matter how much you would like to get rid of him and not have to bother with him, he is in your life for the next 18 years. And if he chooses to voluntarily pay support and do all of that, then you're raising a child with somebody else. So that's the way we define it legally in Vermont. He said it was very surprising to have jumped over all of courtship and marriage to parenting, just like that. And all of their negotiations were not about the wedding. They were about how much she hated him and how much she didn't want him to be involved. So anyway, let's talk about love. Okay, so what is love from a Bronfenbrennerian point of view? Any of you ever feel it? Go ahead. Okay, so are those enough? Reciprocity and positive affect? Okay. Enough? More to it. Okay, you want just the positive affect. Okay. Why not reciprocity? I'm not going to touch that one. I'm sorry. Somebody on this side, I'm not going there. Okay. The question, I think, is whether you have to have reciprocal affection for each other Is love a transactional emotion? Does it involve both people having reciprocal feelings for each other? If it's not, then is that love? Can you love somebody who doesn't love you back? We could talk about parents and infants. We could talk about pet owners and dogs. No, we don't go there. Okay. Anybody have a good definition of love? Did you talk about it at all your parties over the weekend or in the library while you were doing homework? Call your parents. Anybody talk on the cell phone about what is love over the weekend? Anybody remember that was the question we ended with on Wednesday? I should have emailed it to you on Friday. So reciprocity and positive affect may be parts of what you would like to have, but maybe not definitional characteristics of love. I gave you a little hint where I am, standing over in the other corner a few minutes ago when I said I can't define love. I don't know what it is. I can't define it. I know some of its characteristics. I know it when I feel it. So for me, it is an emotion that I'm not going there either. It is an emotion or an affect directed at somebody or something that carries a lot of implications for how I respond to that person, wanting to be with that person, all kinds of other, you know, throwing myself in front of a train for a person, self-sacrifice, and all of those other things. But I don't have a definition that I really particularly like. But I'm much happier talking about the second one. What kind of romantic dyadic relationship do you want? Because I think we can define that. But I challenge you to think about what is love. When you talk about loving a parent, loving a child, when you talk about loving your grandparent, when you talk about loving your roommate, your best friend, your cat, when you get married and say, I love you, I challenge you to think about what that means. And more importantly, I would challenge you to think about how it is expressed. Maybe if I can't define it, maybe I can still talk about how it is expressed. And maybe throwing myself in front of a train is part of the way you express that. Maybe the self-sacrifice is part of that. Maybe putting the other person's welfare above your own is part of that. I don't know. I do know that there are relationships in which the word is used, but the behavior doesn't match. And I caution you against believing the word if the behavior doesn't match. I also caution you about using the word when you don't know how to behave consistently with it, when you don't know how love is expressed. And in a romantic, dyadic relationship, if you're going to talk about love and how it's expressed, then you can talk about love as a joint activity. Then you can talk about the characteristics of a loving relationship and your expectations for each other. And I recommend that you do that. It'll make you an unusual couple to actually talk about what you mean by love and how it's expressed and what your joint activities are that define it. What do people do when they love? What do people not do? How close is it to Bronfenbrenner's definition of a developmental dyad? A developmental dyad is one in which there is mutual positive affect. The joint activities become progressively more complex, and the balance of power gradually shifts in favor of the developing person. That assumes that the power is unbalanced at the beginning. So what that means is that in a loving relationship, the power might be becoming more balanced, more equal in how you carry out the activities of the relationship. I'm not sure that a developmental dyad requires love, and I'm not sure that love fits that definition, but possibilities. Okay, what do you want in a romantic dyadic relationship? You're writing your personal ad. You're writing your personal ad for 7 days. Valentine's is coming up. You want somebody to share your life with, to be in a romantic dyad with. What are you looking for? Go ahead.
Positive affect.
Positive affect. All the time? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, what about fights? Okay. How much negative affect does it have to have? You want one where there's never any negative affect? Okay, you want to be challenged. You want to be made to think, examine your assumptions, brought up short when you're making assumptions sometimes. Are there ways to do that that involve positive affect? Okay, mutual respect, that's a positive affect. Respect is positive. If it's mutual, that's helpful. You can challenge somebody without negative affect. If you're a grown-up, can you be challenged without responding negatively? Probably. Okay, why did I bring up fights? Because fights are when people typically are not engaging in positive affect, not experiencing positive affect. And there is, in our society, a common belief that all couples fight. That fighting is natural, that fighting is part of life, that you can't be in a loving relationship without occasionally fighting. I'm going to challenge that one. And I'm going to challenge it for two reasons. One is that I know relationships in which there is not negative affect, long-term marriages without negative affect. So my experience is that some couples manage quite well without fighting. And I think that that belief is often used as an excuse for bad behavior and immaturity. I'm just going to throw that out and challenge it. That people who believe that fighting is inevitable may be saying either they or their partner is unwilling to learn the skills of challenging without negative affect, of responding to challenge without negative affect. Those are hard skills to learn. But I think that there are couples who manage all of their disagreements without negative affect. There are couples who manage all of their compromises and sometimes long discussions about the very important topics on which they disagree without negative affect.
Does that also speak to like the balance of power within the relationship? Because if people are willing to share power, it seems like they'd be more willing to respect each other.
Yeah. It's a very important point that negative affect in the relationship is very closely tied to imbalance in power or attempts to create imbalance in power or inappropriate exercise of power. And couples who don't have imbalances of power, for whom power is not important to exercise within the relationship, couples for whom exercising power is in fact to be avoided if the intent is to persuade the other person or to get the other person to do something that that person isn't comfortable with or doesn't want to do or doesn't like. For those couples for whom power is not important and who in fact avoid the exercise of power, it is much easier to maintain positive affect over a long period of time, even in the face of very, very difficult decisions on which people disagree. Some couples understand that maintaining the positive affect is an important part of resolving issues. So they incorporate into their negotiation, when there are disagreements, where there are differences of opinion, they incorporate into their communication about those expressions of the long-term goals and their continuing positive affect for each other. They also tend to be couples who, in which both parties are not reactive. They are people who are reflective, who can accept challenge, who can accept their responsibility for change, and who are not threatened by disagreement, who are not threatened by a difference of opinion, and who understand that compromise, negotiation, the joint activity of planning together and coming to agreement together is what coupleship is about, not the exercise of power, not getting your way. Couples in which one or both are interested in getting their way all the time are going to fight all the time, but they've already set that up to do it. What else do you want in your romantic relationships? You want positive affect all the time, even when you disagree. Go for it. It's a challenge. It can be done. Just make sure you're romantically involved with a grown-up or somebody who's interested in becoming one and who appreciates the fact that you are, and then try to be one. Okay, what else do you want? That's it. You want reciprocity? What does that mean? Okay, so both parties can initiate, and both parties can trade roles as part of the reciprocity. that they both do things that are positive for the relationship and for each other. It's not just one person doing all the giving and the other person all the receiving or taking. Right? So you want both parties to be able to give, both parties to be able to take, both parties to be able to receive. Both parties to be engaged is a term I like. That means both are actively involved in the relationship. It's important to both of them. It means it's a molar activity for both of them. The relationship as molar activity. That is reciprocally molar. It's not just one person pursuing the other and trying to maintain a relationship with that person who's not engaged and not responsive. But in a reciprocal relationship, both parties see the relationship as important. It's a molar activity that they both engage in, that they want to become more complex.
Is there an aspect
of using emotion as being reciprocal, or do you have to say that reciprocity has to be there's emotional reciprocity, or is that aspect? Okay, interesting question. When we speak of affect, do we have to specify that the affect is reciprocal? I would say yes, that you can have positive affect that is not reciprocal. And you can have emotionality, various kinds of emotions within a relationship that are not reciprocal. You think of a situation where people are emotional but it's not reciprocal. You would like, if you're enjoying something, for the other person to enjoy it as well. You would like, if you feel really good about what's going on in the relationship, for the other person to feel the same way. You would like, I think, if there's a high degree of reciprocity, that if something is bothering you in the relationship, you would like the other person to be bothered by that as well. So that when you raise an issue, something that's uncomfortable for you, you would like reciprocity in the sense that there's responsiveness to that. If something is bothering you in the relationship, you would like a response which says, ooh, if that's bothering you, then it bothers me too. So let's talk about that. Rather than the non-reciprocal response, which is, this really bothers me, and the other person says, don't let it bother you. Or, don't worry about it. Or, that's stupid. Or, why? How could that bother you? You want the reciprocity of the emotion. If this bothers me, then the other person should be concerned about that too. Not necessarily in the same way that you are, but that there is reciprocation of the concern. So, I haven't felt it that way, but that's something we need to talk about. So that you engage on the basis of your concern about it, and the other person isn't blowing you off. Now, just saying, discounting your reaction. If something about the relationship bothers either one, then there should be a reciprocal response to that. Not panic and not running away, but okay, let's talk about it. Other characteristics of reciprocity? Other ways in which reciprocity gets expressed in a good relationship, the one you want, the one you fantasize about, the one you hope you'll fall into over spring break. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm going to be here enjoying my reciprocal, well-balanced power, high positive affect relationship. Are there ways in which reciprocity? How about reciprocal pleasure? Maybe you're all too young for that. Yeah. I'm thinking sex, actually. they're talking about my relation. Relationships in which each other's pleasure, each other's enjoyment of all kinds of joint activities is important. That celebrating your birthday is as important to the other person as celebrating that person's birthday is to you. That one's been on my mind because we've been doing the invitations for my wife's birthday party, which we're planning. Her mother, her sister, and I are the committee to plan a birthday celebration. If you're going to be 50, you only get to be 50 once. Halfway through life, so you got to celebrate it. The reciprocity in it is that she had so much fun planning my 60th a couple of years ago and threw such a wonderful party for me that I'm letting her plan hers. She's so good at it. So she's involved too. It's not a surprise party, so I can talk to you about it. Okay. But the reciprocity in it is that we all know how much she loves throwing a good party for somebody else. So our pleasure is we're going to throw one for her that's just as good, almost, as one she would throw. We also have developed an understanding within the family that she will probably cater her own funeral. She can't stay out of it. So she's going to plan the celebration. Reciprocity is important. Reciprocity of intimacy. Do you both share your feelings? Do you both share your thoughts? Do you both share your fears? Do both people expect to be fully self-revealing in a romantic relationship? Or does one of you expect to be fully self-revealing and the other person says, figure me out if you can, I'm not going to give you any hints. So you want reciprocity, positive affect most of the time, balanced power, right? Any of you really want somebody that you're much smarter than and have more power than and can put through the ringer and he'll never really challenge you because you're so much more powerful where you get to call all the steps? You don't want that, do you? Well, a couple of you do. Question.
I don't know what this would be called, but there would be different things for people. Like if you're kind of analyzing like good television relationships or something, like there's a hospital, one was a doctor, one was a lawyer, they're both educated people, they're bringing different things to the table. I don't know, but I think that's kind of important.
Okay, the question is it important to bring different things to the table? How does that relate to power or affect or reciprocity? It doesn't have to, but does it?
I think it definitely does, because
right. In the Huxtables, one of the important, you all know the Huxtables, Cosby. It was very important, as it is in many television sitcoms and other kinds of shows, where there are couples, to have them have equal power. And that one was very carefully crafted so that both were very well educated, equal in their professional status and skill, which allowed them to play more at the reciprocity within the plot lines. Desperate Housewives? Do they, in all of their couple of relationships, are they equal power? Interesting to think about the premise for that show. Okay, let's take the last 2 minutes and think about what it does for people to be different, each to bring something different to the table or to the relationship. One of the advantages of that, I don't think it's a requirement, but one of the advantages of that is that it provides a basis for respect if each person is involved in something interesting, not necessarily equal status professions or equal education, but that they have something that they're involved in that creates a mesosystem for each of them that may not completely overlap. It's also helpful if people have something of interest to bring to the relationship so that the relationship is not all there is in their lives. Because it's unlikely that you'll find two people who will make the relationship all they have in their lives. And if that's all you have in your life, then it may say something about power. It may say something about reciprocity. But if you want to engage in joint activities that can get more complex, it may help if you both have something different in your experience to bring to those. Let me put the last overhead up to give you a challenge for Wednesday. In regard to the romantic dyadic relationship, if you're going to think about Bronfenbrenner, we've talked about affect and reciprocity and power, but also think about other Bronfenbrennerian characteristics of dyads. Do you want it to be primary? Do you want it to engage in joint activities that become increasingly complex? Do you want it to be a transcontextual dyad? Do you want to share a mesosystem? And here's another possibility. Bronfenbrenner doesn't describe what goes on in a couple relationship. He talks about different kinds of dyads and the characteristics of relations. But I think there's a piece that is missing if you want to think about consistency. And I haven't talked to him about this. I should, I guess, and see what he thinks about it. But as you look at the relationships between settings in the mesosystem, the whole set of hypotheses about trust and goal consensus and communication and advocacy for each other, positive attitude, promoting that. Interesting to think about people in those hypotheses in a dyad, in relationship, instead of settings. How do the people communicate in a relationship? What kind of interperson knowledge is there? What kind of goal consensus is there in a relationship that you would like to be in? I think if you go back and look at the mesosystem hypotheses and think about people instead of settings, it might suggest a consistent view at a different level. And it's fun to look at that way. So do that, and we'll go on Wednesday and talk about dating.